This is a podcast from WILL AM 580. To support our station, please visit www.willpledge.org. That's www.willpledge.org.
This is the AM 580 News Daily Podcast. For Monday, September 17th, I'm Jeff Bossert. Coming up, the first installment in our series, World War II, Central Illinois Stories. We'll hear about the sinking of the USS Indianapolis in 1945. Nearly 900 men died in that tragedy. And we'll have a look at your AM 580 weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, but first, a look at today's news. Jury selection is set to begin this week in a Miami terrorism case. The government says Narcile Baptiste and six followers were a budding homegrown terrorist cell determined to topple the Sears Tower in Chicago. But defense lawyers and supporters say the so-called Liberty City Seven never sought to hurt anyone. They say the alleged terror conspiracy was driven by a pair of paid FBI informants, one who claimed to be an Al-Qaeda emissary. Aside from a few knives, machetes, and one 9mm handgun, the group never obtained any of the weaponry necessary to pull off such a grandiose operation. The case promises to test the Bush administration's post-September 11th strategy of disrupting potential terrorists in the earliest possible stages. The men each face decades in prison if convicted. Indiana's Commission on State Tax and Finance Policy will hold its final informational meeting this afternoon. Senator Luke Kenley says the group hopes to focus on property tax solutions after today's meeting. The panel of lawmakers and outside tax experts is exploring ways of reducing local government's reliance on property taxes. It may have recommendations for the General Assembly to consider as early as an organization day in November. The group is focusing on the issue this summer and fall because a variety of factors is expected to increase property taxes on homeowners 24% on average statewide this year. Illinois casinos say a public smoking ban set to take effect the first of the year will hurt their bottom line. They're hoping state lawmakers give them special consideration. Sean Crawford reports.
Bars, restaurants, and all public workplaces in Illinois will have to be smoke-free come January. That includes casinos. But Tom Swoik, who lobbies on behalf of the Illinois gaming industry, says it could be devastating for the riverboats.
That's what's still been happening in other states, Delaware and up in Canada. They had about a 20-25% loss in revenues when the smoking bans went into effect.
That's because gaming operations close by allowed smoking. That's also true when it comes to Illinois casinos competition, as neighboring states let people smoke when gambling. Swoik says the latest effort in the Illinois legislature would exempt casinos for up to 5 years. The plan might be tacked onto a measure to pay for hundreds of projects around the state. Anti-smoking groups admit that could make it hard to defeat. They want the casino exemption voted on separately. I'm Sean Crawford.
There's a lot at stake when federal science advisors meet today to consider this summer's death of 36-year-old Jolie Moore of Central Illinois. Moore fell ill the day after her right knee was injected with trillions of genetically engineered viruses as part of an arthritis study. She was dead from organ failure and internal bleeding three weeks later. U.S. health officials are investigating. Officials from Seattle-based Targeted Genetics, the company sponsoring the research, say they're confident investigators will find no connection between the death and the study. Meanwhile, Moore's husband, Rob, says he's waiting for answers. He believes his wife's death, which left him to raise their 5-year-old daughter alone, was avoidable. Lawyers for a Planned Parenthood clinic set to open this week in suburban Chicago are to appeal in federal court to press for an injunction that would allow the health center to open Tuesday, despite efforts by city leaders to keep it closed. The move comes after 800 anti-abortion demonstrators gathered outside the Aurora clinic yesterday to protest. Last month, Aurora leaders launched a review of the permitting process that granted Gemini Office Development LLC, a Planned Parenthood subsidiary, permission to build the $7.5 million facility. The 22,000-square-foot clinic was scheduled to open tomorrow, but Aurora last week refused to issue a necessary occupancy permit. The emergency injunction would allow Planned Parenthood to open the clinic after the temporary occupancy permit expires tomorrow. Students at Purdue University's Black Cultural Center are starting a semester-long study of the blues. The project will include trips to Tennessee and Mississippi to learn about the music and its significance. The Cultural Center began its learning project Saturday. More than 100 people came to learn about Bessie Smith, a famous blues singer from the 1920s and 30s, and how black people lived during that time. Rufus Burns, a senior majoring in film and theater, says he likes the blues because the genre tells stories that have real meaning. Parents who attended the weekend event say they like the idea of students digging deeper into the blues. Billy Boykins of Cincinnati says the genre reflects the struggles America went through during a difficult time. For the latest newscast online, go to wiol.uiuc.edu/news. This is the AM 580 News Daily Podcast. I'm Jeff Bossert. In 1945, a Japanese submarine fired torpedoes at a naval cruiser called the USS Indianapolis. Nearly 900 men would die in the ship's sinking in days that followed in what's been called the worst at-sea disaster in the history of the U.S. Navy. But news of the deaths was overshadowed by Japan's surrender and the end of World War II. Only in recent years have details of what led up to the attack and efforts to hide it been discovered. Here's the first installment in our series, World War II, Central Illinois Stories. Jim O'Donnell of Indianapolis worked as a repairman for an airplane manufacturer in the early 40s. But after a while, even a job that aided the war effort couldn't keep him out of the military. He'd run out of draft deferments and became a U.S. Naval officer.
I got inducted on February of 1944, and it was on Friday the 13th. And I guess I should have seen the handwriting on the wall then.
After a few weeks of training, O'Donnell was sent to California to serve in the boiler room of the USS Indianapolis. The vessel had become the flagship of the U.S. Fifth Fleet. For about 2 years, O'Donnell served on a crew of nearly 1,200 men during assaults on the Mariana Islands, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa. The ship withstood a kamikaze attack that killed 9 crew members. It also played a direct role in ending World War II without firing a shot. The Indianapolis and its crew delivered the atomic bomb to the island of Tanyan just before it was dropped on Hiroshima. A couple days later, just past midnight on July 30, 1945, somewhere between Guam and the Philippines, O'Donnell was asleep near one of the vessel's gun turrets.
I woke up and all you could see when I looked forward was a big ball of fire. I mean, you wore a little rubber life preserver at all times. And around the ship in bags, they had these Kapok life jackets. We walked over to them and got a Kapok life jackets, then walked down the side of the ship, slid down the bottom of the ship into the water, swam a little ways, looked back, and all you could see was the ship going down.
The USS Indianapolis had been struck by 2 torpedoes fired from a Japanese sub. It took just 12 minutes for the ship to sink. While about 300 men died on board, nearly 900 were left floating, most of them without rafts, and no food, water, or protection from the elements below. Don McCall is an Indianapolis survivor from Champaign.
You're just absolutely petrified. You just can't believe being out there helpless, and these sharks are in the water. You see them, but you don't pay attention to them. You're trying to get away from them, you know, and there's no place to go.
A series of missteps prevented a speedy rescue mission. O'Donnell, McCall, and the others still breathing spent 5 days of despair before they were spotted on a routine naval flight. 317 men were saved, but it was weeks before anyone else found out what really happened, even military families. Mary O'Donnell is Jim's wife.
I got my telegram on August 13th, and on the 14th it came out that the Japanese had surrendered and that the war was over, and in finer print that the heavy cruiser Indianapolis had been sunk. And that's the first that I had heard, you know, of what had actually happened. My telegram said he was suffering from immersion, which I had no idea what that meant.
One of the survivors, the ship's captain, Charles McVeigh, had little time to recover from his wounds. He was court-martialed and convicted later that year of failing to zigzag or taking proper evasive action to avoid the disaster. But survivors say McVeigh was made a scapegoat to hide the mistakes of others. The conviction had not only cost the captain his seniority, but his pride. He committed suicide in 1968. And it wasn't until 30 years later that the most unlikely of sources, a young teen, led the effort to clear McVeigh's name. Hunter Scott was watching the movie Jaws on TV one day and came to a monologue delivered by Captain Quint. The character talked about being on the Indianapolis and losing shipmates in the days following the submarine attack.
And it is because of that that he dedicated the rest of his life to taking revenge on sharks, because of what the sharks had done to so many of his shipmates when their ship sank and they were in the water. And so it was because of that scene right there that I stood up and asked my dad if it were a true story. He knew about as much as I did. He thought it was true, but neither of us really knew. And from that point, I went to the library and started doing research on the Indianapolis, found out it was true, and found out so much more.
Scott chose the tragedy for his National History Day project. At the age of 14, he appeared before Congress with survivors of the vessel, arguing that Captain McVeigh was innocent. Scott says President Clinton formally cleared the captain's name in 2000.
Gordon England, who was the Secretary of the Navy at that time, had someone pull Captain McVeigh's naval record, attach the legislation to it that said he was not responsible for the loss of his ship, and that essentially changed what was written in history books and had been written in history books for almost 60 years.
And it's a history that's received more attention in recent years.
You could study this ship for probably 5 years and still not know everything there is to know about it.
Ken McNamara is with the USS Indianapolis Museum and its new exhibit at the Indiana War Memorial. The gallery, which opened in July, tracks the ship's earliest days through the 1945 tragedy. In the 1930s, President Roosevelt used the vessel as his ship of state.
That's 800 pounds of brass that was removed from the ship at the beginning of World War II so they could have more ammunition and guns.
McNamara rings a bell with the ship's name and the year of its maiden voyage, 1932, inscribed in it. One end of the exhibit tracks the vessel's journey through a variety of harbors, the majority of them within U.S. borders. The other details the ship's extensive service during World War II, including the delivery of the atomic bomb. The site also holds the uniforms of a few who survived the ship's sinking and pictures of some who didn't. When 40 of the 81 remaining survivors of the USS Indianapolis returned for their biannual reunion this summer, they held a ribbon cutting to commemorate the new exhibit. Jim O'Donnell, who spent most of his life in the city, says he returns to the exhibit often.
If you stop and figure, you know, you pay a price sometimes for everything you do. Now, we took a bomb over there that ended the war, that killed thousands of people, but we paid an awful price for it. We lost a great ship, 880 men. Kind of balance things out. That's one way to look at it.
The story of what those men went through in 1945 expects to get more exposure soon. A handful of books have been written, and a Hollywood movie based on Hunter Scott's research is in the works, with its release slated for 2009. I'm Jeff Bossert, AM 580 News. You can see pictures and read more about the stories of USS Indianapolis survivors online at WIOL's special page dedicated to the war stories of Central Illinois. It's at wiol.uiuc.edu. And coming up in the afternoon magazine today at 2:40, we'll hear an interview I did with Naval Aviator Hunter Scott. He continues his efforts to correct misconceptions on the history of the Navy vessel. Tomorrow, AM 580's Tom Rogers talks to Hoopston residents who remember when the city hosted German prisoners of war, and to a man who spent time as a prisoner in that camp. In the forecast for the region today, partly sunny, warmer, a high of 82 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear, the low around 60 in town and mid to upper 50s in nearby rural locations. Mostly sunny tomorrow, the high 86. Partly cloudy tomorrow evening, the low 61. For Wednesday, partly sunny, a high of 86 degrees. This has been the AM 580 News Daily Podcast for Monday, September 17th. You can find podcasts of Focus 580, the afternoon magazine, agricultural programming, as well as other helpful information at our website, wiol.uiuc.edu. I'm Jeff Bossert, AM 580 News.